When I learned that I was worthy of self-love, a love that was worthy showed up. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. How we be doing? For any new listeners, my name is Andrea, formerly known as Awkwardly Tall Girl. I am a recovering shit show. You should be really glad I don't drink anymore, truly. I once peed my pants at a Ruth's Chris, completely sober. What other embarrassing tidbits can I give you? Oh, well, actually, I meant to tell you guys this last week. I don't know. Should I? I feel like this is really just might really weird out anybody who's new. But I'm going to go for it, okay? I'm going to go for it. We use this beginning part to weed out those who aren't going to be a good fit here, right? As I said, I am an acquired taste. So I was talking with this guy like, a week ago, and it turns out that he grew up close to where I grew up in the suburbs of Philly, and we're chatting back and forth, and he makes a comment about him getting sent away to a wilderness program and then a therapeutic boarding school. And it actually turns out that he got sent to the same wilderness program that my boyfriend got sent to. It was called Ascent. It was in Idaho. And so I told him that I too had been sent to a therapeutic boarding school in Maine. And so I decided to send him the episode that I had where I had Lucy, who was one of my classmates at this boarding school, on the podcast. And so I sent him this episode for him to listen to it. And so he's kind of giving me like his, you know, commentary on what he's listening to. And so he sends a text. He says, Willard's water ad. Impressive. I guess that there was an advertisement for Willard's water. I've never heard of Willard's, and that's what I said. I responded, never heard of Willard. And then he wrote back and he said, apparently you've heard of pooping out babies. So I realized that, like, in this episode with Lucy, realized this. I tell Lucy this story about how when I was in the sixth grade, about how I told one of my best friends, I like made up that I had sex and that I got pregnant and that I pooped out the baby. Oh my God. So yeah, he goes, apparently you've heard of pooping out babies. Very wild. And I said, who hasn't heard of pooping out babies? And he wrote, I've been educated. I feel like I should put together like an Andrea's greatest hits that I should just like send out to any potential suitors to see if they're a good fit or not. Let's just move it along, and I just want to deeply apologize to today's guest for this shit show of an intro that she's getting, because today we are diving deep with an icon in my book. So we are joined by Lisa Romano, the codependency queen, the author of so many damn books, so many amazing YouTube videos. She is out there doing the work, helping us shit shows to heal and recover. This conversation really fed my soul. She is one of us. She knows this adult child stuff like the back of her hand. I want to give a shout out to her book, Codependent, Now What? It's Not You, It's Your Programming. This book is really damn good. It really should be called Adult Child, Now What? It really is all adult child shit. One thing that was really powerful, and it was talking about the ways in which we seek validation outside of self. So let me give you a couple of these. We anticipate the needs of others, secretly wishing to cause others to depend on us in unhealthy ways so that they never leave us.
We say yes when we mean no, and no when we mean yes because we fear making others angry. We tolerate being ignored, abused, lied to, chastised, and the like, so that we do not have to enforce a boundary and possibly have to face abandonment and loss. We seek ways in which we can become subservient to others, secretly hoping we might be able to convince others we are worthy to keep around. Yowza. Go read this book. So let's get the damn show on the road. A few things first. Stay tuned for when you can join the new community, the shit show coming soon to ya. This is a healing community for recovering shit shows, for recovering adult children, where you can get the support that you need, where you can feel heard, seen, and understood like never before with people who also have a sense of humor. We also have fun in this community. So adult child recovery is rough, tough stuff. It's not for sissies, but you can also have fun doing so. And that's why I created this community, because there is a lot of joy and fun and laughter to be had as we go through this process of peeling this damn onion. So stay tuned for information on how you can join this new community when I open it up in a couple weeks. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. If you're new here, that's what we do here. So do it now. Thanks. Love you.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right, y'all, this woman needs no introduction. We have Lisa Romano. Are you a GCOA, a grandchild of an alcoholic?
Yes, but my parents weren't diagnosed. I would, you know, they would never say yes, but you know, the whole denial thing. Like, my mom goes to Ireland, she comes back, she's hiding Bailey's, right? And then just says, oh, I'm not going to drink anymore, but I'm not an alcoholic. Well, she was a dry alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
you're all the things.
Yeah.
When did you first hear the term adult child?
Interesting. I'd always, the first time I heard the term adult child was probably in therapy, when I was losing everything, my mind, my body, my marriage. It was an interesting concept to be granted permission from someone outside of myself, who was obviously a lot smarter than I was, who said, you've got this thing, you know, you're an adult child of an alcoholic. And I went, that's a thing. And I have a right to say that my childhood sucked and that there was something wrong with the way that I was raised, because the denial, don't ever say that, never mention anything outside this house. You know, what happens in this house stays in this house. You know, the shame and the no talk rule, it was programmed into me to not even consider that what was wrong inside of me had something to do with what was being done to me or part of what I was experienced. I felt effed up, therefore it was my fault, period. And so to be given permission to like break out of that parameter, that faulty paradigm, was life-changing. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. It's like being 12 years old and finding like $10 million. What do I do next? I don't know. I have no idea. Must be a good thing, but I don't know how to like manage money and set myself up for a life. I don't know how to use it, but I knew that it was important. And that really started my recovery process through consciousness and understanding the subconscious mind. And,
oh, shit. Okay. Oh, for a second, I thought I didn't press record, but I did. Sorry. I was like, ah. Yeah. So it's interesting. So I found out my mom was an alcoholic when I was seven. They told me. Wow. Obviously, that made a lot of sense, right? Wow. So I was just reading back through your books, both of your, what do you call them, memoirs. Do you want to highlight, like, what do you feel like are a few experiences from your childhood that really paint the picture of what the dynamics were like in your home?
One scenario that pops into my mind right away is being 9 or 10 years old. And back then in the 70s, you could literally babysit like three kids at like 9 or 10. Yeah. No, it sounds crazy.
Drive them around, be an Uber driver at 9.
I don't know if I go that far, but like, you know, being older than Google, like we got away with things that like, it was just insanity. But anyway, I was like babysitting at 9 and 10 years old. And if Rosie down the block did good at bingo, she'd come home and she'd reward me as long as her kids were okay. Yeah. And I didn't know what to do with this money, but I knew at the time I was aching to like have a connection to my mom. And her feet were always chapped because she was obsessed with cleaning the house. And so literally they were cracked and bleeding. And I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the store and buy her a pair of sneakers. So I get on my bike and I go down to the Woolworth store. And I'm just so excited that I'm going to buy mommy a pair of sneakers with the money that I made. And she's going to know how much I love her. And she's outside on our stoop in Queens smoking a cigarette. And I'm super excited. My heart's like pumping. And I give her this box like, mommy, you know, I here. And she opened up the sneakers and with a very stoic expression, what do you think you can buy, my love, Lisa? And I was crushed. It was all the life was drained out of me. Like I wanted to do something good. Now it's been perceived as something bad. What's wrong with me for trying to do this, trying to love her, trying to show her it's bad, it's bad, it's bad. And that really was the nature of my relationship with my mother for the entirety of our life. I don't ever remember having a nurturing experience with my mother, except one time when I tripped down the stairs and her friend was over, a woman I had never met before. And I was kind of shocked because my mother was like, oh, come sit on mommy's lap. So that told me later on that you knew
what to do, how to be, yeah.
You knew when you were being nurturing, when you were withholding nurturing, and you shouldn't have. So this was selective nurturing. So the idea that there was some conscious understanding that she was withholding affection from me was just another layer of like acceptance and grieving that I had to go through, you know, on the recovery journey. So that's that really sticks out in my mind.
Oh, yeah, I remember that story. God, yeah. Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You had a sister and a brother?
Yep.
And what was your mother's relationship like with them?
I think it's pretty typical of dysfunctional families where we all had roles to play.
Yeah. Where
it was really interesting. I was my father's golden child, but my mother's scapegoat. So it really pissed her off that my father thought I was smart. It really, and I would cringe, like, please don't acknowledge me, Dad, because I don't understand, but that's going to make mommy mad. So I had to refrain from accepting his love because I just intuitively understood, look, she's not happy, you know? And so I was her scapegoat. And then I would say my sister was her golden child. But she triangulated me against my brother. In other words, it was the two of them. So he also felt like she could withhold. And so this was an opportunity for him to bond with her by having an alliance against me. And so coming home from school at 12 years old or 11 years old, having a really rough day because, of course, I got bullied at school.
Yeah, you had a horrible experience at school.
Oh, yeah. I had shaped my life. But I had you know, low self-esteem and all that, didn't feel like I was worthy of friendship. So how could I be myself? I couldn't. I had constantly edit myself, and the level of self-consciousness to a debilitating degree was a daily part of my life. And coming home and hearing my mom and my brother laughing at the top of the staircase and thinking, oh my God, that sounds so nice. Like they're laughing, because my mom did not laugh. No. And I drop my book bag and I'm walking up the stairs. And as I get closer to the top of the stairs, I recognize what they're doing. They're reading my diary, laughing. And it was a CPTSD response. I lost all emotional control. It was just a wicked experience to go from, wow, they sound so happy. And again, that moment of hope being pulled away from me. And then like to be so upset that you're laughing at a diary, because my mind was the only place that I felt like they couldn't touch, like my secrets, like I'm not revealing my secrets to you. So to know that my mother violated that and then brought my brother in, and the two of them thought this was funny. And then on top of it, look at her. She's crazy. Look at her falling apart. You're crazy. You're crazy. On top. So now my reaction is wrong. Mm-hmm. It was just really effed up, you know. But that really was what she did. So she triangulated my brother against me. So it was really, when you come from a toxic home, you know, nobody's steering the ship. Like, like you're in bumper cars, man. It's like no one knows where they're going. You know, people are getting run over. Nobody cares. Everybody pretends the legs aren't broken. It's just mayhem. But what's really crazy and debilitating, I think, all of it. But as a child, when you know that your inner reality doesn't match your outer reality, and everybody's pretending like everything's okay, nothing's okay.
It's such a mind fuck. Oh.
God, especially for a little kid, you know, a little kid whose brain is trying to wire for, you know, some semblance of what is the world and how do I fit in it? So when nothing makes sense in the outer world, you know, our brains don't wire for a sense of continuity, a sense of rational thinking. It doesn't. Our mind is chaotic, and that creates tension in our body that we eventually learn how to alleviate through sex or through drinking or through shopping or sticking our fingers down our throat. You know, we naturally gravitate towards some way to alleviate this tension that nobody in our outer experiences is acknowledging, mm-hmm. or knows how to help us. If they did acknowledge it, they wouldn't know how to help us. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's like the inmates have the keys, you know, it's like,
shit.
Who's the boss? You know,
okay. I developed separation anxiety at 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents sent me to a therapist, and I remember asking years later, I'm like, did you ever tell that therapist that you're an alcoholic and that you guys fought all the time? I mean, mom's answer was, no, it did not seem relevant.
Denial.
Yeah.
Again, it's like the person, you know, in the American Indian tradition, mm-hmm. back in the day, if you brought a sick child that was acting up to the medicine woman, she looked to the parents and she said, what have you done?
Mm.
It was immediately understood that this child's behavior was an effect and not the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there is a child that is, in most cases, I mean, there are anomalies,
yes,
but
yes,
I think it is a safe argument to be had when we recognize that the child's behavior is response to something that's happening outside of them. My mom, I was 7 years old. So my first grade teacher said, I think Lisa needs a therapist.
Especially for back in that day, that's kind of saying a lot, right?
My mother would not take me to a therapist.
Mm-hmm. Of course
not. And I know why. Because she was afraid I might tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I was withdrawn and I wasn't able to acclimate and I was inhibited, you know, and it was difficult for me to like merge with the other kids, she was seeing. And my need for her approval, she could see it. And she was a young teacher, but my mother didn't tell me that until I was well into my 30s, but she used it as a rationale to justify her feelings towards me. Well, he was seven. I said to her, I said, Mommy, do you realize that as young as seven, I used to hear you telling your friends that you were mean to me because we had a personality conflict. I was seven. So she was what, 28 by that time? So I was seven. She was 28. Super young.
Yeah,
right?
She was a baby. Mm-hmm.
Oh, she was actually 26. Wow. Right? So she was a baby. Mm-hmm. Right? But what does an immature mind do? It rationalizes cognitive bias. So an unawakened mind doesn't understand itself. So my mother, being the adult child of an alcoholic, had all sorts of denial, right? Thought what a lot of adult children of alcoholics do. I just won't drink and my life should be easy. No, it will happen to you. It's just like it happens to everybody else until you fix it.
Yeah, I almost wonder if things would have been better for you if she had been drinking.
I think I've thought about that in the past, and I think the difference would have been, oh, it's alcohol. So maybe it's not just mm-hmm. I'm that. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, Mommy drinks, and that's why she's that way. I could have possibly made a correlation, but to me it was just, no, it's you, you're bad, and that's why Mommy is this way.
Yeah, I thought that was such a powerful moment in your book when you talk about that. And I guess it was the shoe incident, but like when you really did, because I think a lot of kids subconsciously feel like it's their fault, but for you to have that very conscious awareness of I'm bad. Oh. And so do you say that, like when John Bradshaw talks about, like, you know, shameless acting in and shameful acting out, would you say that you went the shameless acting in route?
Yeah. And I think women do that more than men. It was, I'm shame. It was such a profound moment that I could, if I took you back to the town that I was raised in, I could show you the exact spot on the street I was on when I had that moment. Lisa, you don't go and buy your mommy nice cards, you know, that say all these lovey, you know, mushy.
Because there was another thing, you gave her a card and she never read it, right? Or, and then you followed up with her about it.
Well, I wrote her a poem and I put it on her pillow and she's like, yeah, I threw it away or whatever. Like she just constantly discarded it, you know, but there was another time where I thought there was constant attempt for connection, right? Which is so innate. We're driven to it. It's tied to survival. You know, but we throw ourselves up against the wall and run into traffic, you know, for people who don't get it. So we have to awaken, right? So that's the cornerstone of codependency. It's like, I just keep trying to get you to see me and love me. But there was another time where I took my bike, my blue Schwinn, and went to this little stationery store. And I just thought, I'll just show her. I just have to show her that I love her. And I bought a card. When I went to buy the card, I brought it to the counter and I lost my nerve. And I thought, you don't do these things because you're bad. So my inner narrative, my inner critic had downloaded the message, you're bad. And so there was a cognitive bias within my own psyche towards my own self. You're bad, so doing something good doesn't make sense. Go get the freaking Charleston Chew can of Pepsi and a bag of onion and garlic potato chips because you don't do these good things. You're bad. So it's taken me quite a long time to unravel the psychological piece, the spiritual piece, and the emotional piece, but I would have it no other way because I'd still be acting out these patterns.
Absolutely. So when you leave your marriage, at what point, well, I guess two questions. At what point did you kind of come to terms with the true impact that your childhood had on you? And at what point did you realize that you had complex PTSD?
Oh, they were very different moments in time.
Yeah.
The complex PTSD came later where, mm-hmm. again, it was like Shrek says, I was an onion.
Never fucking ending onion.
Yeah. But it does get better. It gets sweeter towards the middle. Right. But it was this, okay, I have permission to understand that my parents didn't do such a great job. Okay. They're adult. Okay. Okay. I have permission granted. Wow. I'm codependent. Wow. I'm allowed to say I'm not happy. Permission granted. Permission granted. And so it was through therapy with a very intuitive therapist. And they really didn't they can't diagnose you with codependency because it's not in the DSM, right? So it's a cluster of symptoms, and it takes a very intuitive therapist, psychologist, or psychiatrist to be able to understand the dynamics at the root of this behavior. So he understood codependency because he was a recovering codependent. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, you're depressed, you have clinical depression, but that's because you're codependent. And you're codependent because you were raised by two unrecovered adult children of alcoholics. I was like, what? And so it was at that point, it was like permission granted to look within. Amen. So I learned everything I could about codependency, and the bells started to go off. And to be honest, my therapist didn't talk a lot, but like a lot of therapists don't do. It's like 45 minutes of listening to me, blah, 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 you know? But when he did speak, I held on to every word. And that's when I started to do I've always been very curious by nature, and I started to dig in deep. I was like, okay, if I was raised by two people who are unrecovered, what would have looked like for me if I was raised by healthy, well-adjusted people? And that's when I started to doing this side-by-side analysis. And I thought, well, if I was a healthy adult, then that would be because I was raised in a healthy environment. So what would a healthy child have received? And I ran through, I have a nursing background. So I went back to my psychology books. I was like, oh, Erickson stages of emotional development. Oh, I was screwed between 0 and 18 months. Mm-hmm. Trust versus mistrust. Mm-hmm. And I just went through like what should have happened. And I was validated and horrified at the same time. Like, how could such murder of a soul happen under the eyes of a school system, under the eyes of my grandmother, my grandfather, my aunts, my uncles? My mother's friends knew that I was being emotionally tortured. My father knew. How could my little soul have been so murdered?
No one did anything.
And no one did anything. Everyone pretended it wasn't happening, right? Because as I started to realize the damage that was done at an emotional and psychological level, like I said, it was validating and crushing at the same time. Mm-hmm. But at least it was helping me understand the self. So mm-hmm. then suddenly, I had this separation of consciousness, which allowed me to have compassion for myself, which happened to me at 12 years old when I attempted to take my life. There was this moment of separation between the image of me in the mirror with a gun to my head, right? There was this moment of separation where, wait a minute, I'm not that person, but I could observe that person's pain. And in that space was the miracle of empathy, which was void in my family. There was no empathy, right? So how could I have empathy for the self? I just beat myself up. I don't know what self-compassion looks like. No one's ever had compassion for me, right? And so it was that moment of separation that in terms of my consciousness that saved me at 12 years old. And then again, it was like, whoop, another moment of separation while I was going through the healing journey that allowed me to have empathy for the young woman I was. And I started, my inner narratives just started to change. Like, Lisa, it could be no other way. Mm-hmm. You know, and then poof, it's not you, it's your programming. You were programmed. You were neurologically wired at a subconscious level, right? So here, as a spirit incarnate, which I believe that we are, essence, I am subject to the laws that govern this body. And those are my five senses. And that's the default setting of my brain. I'm not responsible for an innate need to bond with my mother, mm-hmm. for me to develop psychologically sound. Mm-hmm. I didn't create that need. And I'm not responsible for what happens in my brain mm-hmm. when that need goes awry. Mm-hmm. I'm not responsible for that. Mm-hmm. There are going to be psychological consequences when a child feels rejected and cannot bond with, especially their mother. So if I was codependent, and if I wasn't the mother that I wanted to be, if I wasn't the wife I wanted to be, if I wasn't the person I wanted to be, I had to accept that because it could be no other way based on the parameters that govern the physical world and govern my brain. and govern the experiences that I was not responsible for. But I did have, I felt, a responsibility, a right, and an obligation to heal so I could break the cycle. Mm-hmm. And that's what I decided to do.
And then when did the PTSD aha come?
I think the PTSD aha came well after I was out of my relationship with my ex-husband. And I found, I was like, why is he still triggering me? Like, he's out of my life. Like, we live separately. Like, why, when he texts me, do I feel like my brain is on fire? Because I literally, it was like my brain, it was like zapped.
Yeah, in a second.
Instantaneously. Yep. It could be a yep. look.
Yeah.
Because he was stalking me at where I worked. So it could just be a truck that looked like his truck. Mm. It could be the kids saying, mommy, daddy said, or, hey, I bumped into your ex. It could be anything associated with him. And I realized that it was this automation process that was happening that I didn't have conscious control over. And that's when I was like, I don't want anything controlling me on the outside, but I am being controlled by something on the inside that's being triggered by something on the outside. And that's when I understood triggers, emotional flashbacks, because I'd be talking to my best friend and she'd be like, where are you? I was like, what do you mean? She said, you're not here. And I didn't even know I was fading into the background of an emotional flashback. It was just so normal. I was being pulled back in time. And it was when she said things to me like, you're not here. I was like, you're right. And again, separation of consciousness, I began to observe when it was happening. Mm. And that's when I started to understand, oh, this is CPTSD. It's bigger than him, because I also had the same reaction to my mother. And so he was her emotional twin. And in my body, that was my program twin, right? That was the program. He represented the energy that I had with her and the patterns that she helped create inside of me. And so that's why they were, in my opinion, one and the same. I married my mother.
Mm-hmm. So what happened with me is my picker wasn't getting any better. Mm-hmm. You know, right? Like, I got sober and all of my other friends' pickers were kind of screwed up, but they started to improve.
Yep.
And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I couldn't figure out why in each relationship I felt and acted crazier
yep.
each time.
Yep.
And so I'm 7 years sober. I date somebody for less than a month. Mm-hmm. He ghosts me and I want to fucking kill myself.
Yep.
And that was my first aha. It was, there's no way that this reaction could have anything to do with him.
Right.
He's an alcoholic that I've known for less than a month. The second aha was, this is a feeling that I felt often as a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was the exact same, the separation anxiety feeling with my mom, the exact same thing. But like, nobody, I mean, I had been in AA for, you know, 7 years. Like, nobody had, it was like, why the fuck didn't anybody have any idea? I had no idea that I was living in a trauma response every time I was in a relationship.
Girl,
you know,
girl. It's
like so many people who have no, that's why I created this podcast, right? Like, there's so many people out there who have no fucking clue that they have complex PTSD.
Well, what we're talking about, you know, I don't think it's our fault. I think that this psychological community has failed us. I think that the self-help movement has failed us. Mm-hmm. I think, we're finally having, and certainly people of your generation will take it further than how I've taken it, right? So I wanted to be part of the movement where it's like, okay, there's something wrong here and it's bigger than forgiveness.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's bigger than positive affirmations, mm-hmm. right? And it's bigger than me being in therapy for 20 years and you never asking me about my relationship with my mother and my father.
Mm-hmm.
Or are you saying that I have no right to bring up my ex because he's not sitting next to me? Well, he's refusing to come to therapy, right? So we go to the psychological community and we're asked to talk about how we feel. But we're never really taught that our feelings are the result of what we believe. And then we're never really taught about what parameters create a belief, right? So we focus a lot on the symptoms, mm-hmm. try to make people's anxiety go away, yet anxiety is divine truth. Something's wrong and my body knows it. And we're not taught that until I get my mental toughness in order, until I learn to think in a rational, logical way, right? Until I develop my cognitive faculties, then I'm always going to believe that what I believe is true. And therefore, I will always feel the way I always feel. Therefore, I will always make the same decisions I have always made. Therefore, I will always pick the wrong person. So I think, you know, that I believe the psychological community is changing, at least I hope it is, where we move towards teaching patients to better understand the self rather than just tell me about how you feel and, you know, when does anxiety happen for you and how can we develop some skills around you counting to 10. It's like asking somebody who has high cholesterol, how mm-hmm. can we get you to not drive past that bakery every day after work so you don't feel compelled to stop the car and go get yourself a cannoli? Mm-hmm. There's a bigger issue mm-hmm. here. This person is not taking care of the self. This person might be stuffing themselves as a way to anesthetize themselves and to flee from pain. Maybe food was the way this person was comforted as a child because no one was there for them. So, and then the self-help community, I grew up in the age of Louise Hay, where it was a lot of just think positively. I love me Louise Hay. But we're not when we're talking about my inability to move my life forward in a positive way, no matter how hard I try, no matter how many affirmations I do, no matter how much medication I take, no matter how willing I am to forgive, we're talking about CPTSD. We're talking about my brain's automatic response to an external stimuli that has to do with implicit memory, of which I have absolutely no flipping control. Mm-hmm. No control. I can develop more cognition and consciousness around the way that I feel. I can do that, but that takes some skill, coaching, training.
Time.
And self-love.
Yeah.
And self-love, for sure. So it's not our fault. It's not our fault. So it really, and I think that's why life coaching has become the billion-dollar industry it is. That's why I think podcasts by people like you do explode, because people have been living it, are talking it. We've tried the AA. I've done the 12 steps. I love 12-step meetings. There's a place in recovery for them. Me mm-hmm. personally, I was kind of left flat in CODA, because I wasn't getting the tools I needed to overcome codependency, the actual tools. I'm just being honest. Although I believe that we need a place where we can go, where people are speaking our language and we don't feel so alien anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, AA obviously saved my life, but you know, I had no idea what was to come. You know, I'm glad that nobody told me that, oh, at 9 years sober, you're going to be in even more pain than you are right now with one day sober, because I don't know if I would have stayed sober. But it's been so interesting for me, because now it's like I just view everything so differently. You know, I really just view my alcoholism as a symptom of just this trauma, you know?
You're right. So you're talking about a shift in consciousness, which is a conversation that's left out of therapy sessions. It's left out of our interviews with psychiatrists. Well, what level of consciousness do you think you're at when you feel that you want to drink? Or mm-hmm. what level of consciousness do you think your trauma is at? Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's a cause and effect universe. Like, what level of consciousness do you think you're at? Now, suddenly just that question causes a mind to question itself. There are different levels of consciousness. Einstein says you can't solve a problem from the same level of intelligence that created the problem. Mm-hmm. So if I'm an active alcoholic, then, and my best friend, we're trying to help recover right now, you know, she's not going to be able to resolve this issue from the same level of consciousness that created the issue. There has to be a shift in consciousness for her to be able to objectify the whatever experiences helped create this issue, the psychological and physical dependency upon alcohol, which, by the way, makes sense because the brain is designed to run away from forest fires, not towards them. The brain is actually wired to alleviate stress. And whatever is I have been programmed to think does that best is my first choice.
Mm-hmm.
We all make sense. Addiction is about, it's not about any lack in any of us. Addiction is about us trying to manage pain. That's what it's about.
Were your parents still alive when you got into recovery, like deeply? Like, your mom's still young. Are your parents still alive?
No, my parents have passed, but fairly recently. I published my first book in 2012, and I had been writing it for a decade. And when I met my husband, Anthony, he's like, so what do you do in your spare time? I'm like, well, I'm writing this book. He's like, what's it about? It's like codependency. Oh, what's codependency? And I tell him, he's like, why don't you publish it? I was like, well, I don't know. It might hurt my feelings. He's like, well, isn't that codependent? Light bulb moment. And then we're all codependent. My sister, my brother, and I, sister was in a very toxic, dysfunctional marriage. And after about 20 years, she was done. Didn't handle it very well on the outs. Okay, granted. My brother-in-law was not happy with her wanting to get a divorce. And he devolved very, very quickly into a world of Xanax and alcohol, threatening suicide. And I called my parents and I said, listen, he's working up his nerve. And I was called crazy and overdramatic, just like I always was. And called my sister. I said, he's working up his nerve. I said, he needs help. And she basically told me to mind my own business at the time. And almost a month to the day, he took his own life.
Mm.
And when I got the news, my brother called me and he said, Lisa, he took his life. I just hit the ground because I was riding the road back to me. And I knew in my heart that if he knew this information, because his parents were alcoholics, I thought if he knew this information, if he understood himself, he would not have done this. Mm-hmm. He would have understood. It's difficult. Divorce is difficult. But when you're talking about the wounds of an adult child, you're talking about abandonment trauma. You're talking about this sense of being separated from this person that you love that causes us to feel as if we've slipped off a mountain backwards into this abyss with this, it's bottomless. We're free falling, right? Abandonment is akin to death.
Yeah, tell me about it.
The brain reacts to abandonment the same way it does to a threat of death. So all of the bells and whistles are going to go on. And without coping skills and without higher states of consciousness, it's all consuming. So yes, no one, as someone who felt like she wanted to die, I didn't want to die. I wanted the pain to stop.
Exactly.
I didn't want to die. I just wanted someone to give a shit. I wanted someone to stop hurting me. I wanted someone to advocate for me, you know, just somebody just stop the madness, you know, but I couldn't name the madness. The madness was me, according to my family, you know? But in that moment, literally there was a light. I saw a light in my head and I thought, I have to publish that book if it helps save one person. And if that means my parents don't talk to me anymore, so be it. If that means my brother, my sister don't talk, I will be able to live my life. It was that strong of a calling inside of me to write The Road Back to Me. And so my mother called me one day and she said, I want you to know, I know about the book. And I thought, oh shit, here it comes.
I didn't know about it, she said?
She said, I want you to know, I know about it.
Okay.
So
had you told any of them?
I didn't tell anybody.
Were you already a public figure at that point?
No.
Okay.
No, I was just in my head. Yeah. You know, I'm doing my own thing. Single mom, three kids. I'm running a personal training business. You know, I have my little website going. I'm good. But I have this thing that I have to do. I have to write this book and get out there. And then, you know, I'm good. But it just, people started emailing me. you know, and that's just they, and I could not talk to them about this book. And I thought, this is amazing. Like it went to an Amazon bestseller overnight. Wow. You know, it went to 25 overnight, you know, out of all the books out there on codependency and adult child of alcoholic issues. Like, so I was like, oh, okay, what is this thing? And I think that's what happens automatically when you align with your divine purpose, mm-hmm. when you follow that impulse to do something that feels important to you. I don't care if it's like, I love roses and I want a beautiful rose garden. Follow it. You don't know where it's going to lead you. So I think I really aligned with divinity when I published that book. Carl Jung would say I was individualizing. I was becoming my true self versus having a slave mentality, a slave to my parents' programming, a slave to worry about what other people are going to think about me. Because you know you're going to get labeled crazy when you start telling the truth, mm-hmm. right? So it was actually my ex in retaliation. He knew I had written the book. The kids had told him. And he
reached out to your parents.
Yeah. And yeah. So
did you read it?
My ex?
No, your mom.
I have no idea. I don't think so. I have a feeling it's all part of the denial system for the same reason that she didn't send me to a therapist at 7, you know, but she did say, she said, your sister showed me the first 3 chapters online, because if you go to Amazon, you could read introduction. And she said, from what I can tell, she said, everything you're saying is true. And she said, I understand your message.
Wow.
That was huge for my mom.
Wow.
Huge. Huge. We never talked about my book again, but that was really big of my mom.
No kidding. And so then what kind of transpired as you stepped into this, you know, role and healer, and how did that impact the relationship?
Thank God for the rules around codependency, because it was just, I have to focus on validating myself. I have to release other people of the burden of needing to validate me. Mm-hmm. I have to release people of the responsibility of agreeing with me. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I'm called to be myself, right? And I have to learn to tolerate other people's perceptions of me. I have to give people permission. And I had to frame it this way so I understood what I was doing. I had to give people permission to view me through any lens that they wanted, mm-hmm. which allowed me to say, it's okay that you see me that way. You know, I have no right to control your perception of me. You're an individual, you know, you're on your own path. And based on your history, based on the parameters that your ego have constructed for you, you feel the way you do about me. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to be a slave to your projection. I'm not going to spend my life trying to convince you I'm not who you think I am. I'm done. Fucking done. And so with all of that running in the background and me practicing it every day, mm-hmm. I mean, me saying no to my family, no, I'm not coming to that dinner. You know, mm-hmm. Uncle Larry's coming. He is a vicious alcoholic. He calls me the C word. I'm not going to expose my children to that. Saying no to my family system and then knowing, here it comes, she's crazy, she make a big deal out of nothing, right? So it was like, I know it's coming, it's predictable. And I just said, namaste, I accept it. You know, you can't get mad at a gorilla for hanging out of a tree. Mm-hmm. I learned to stop getting angry at people who were unrecovered for acting a fool.
Yeah.
Right? Right? Like, it's okay. I expect you to act this way. So it's just like, ugh, again. So now I'm not a slave to trying to disprove their opinion of me. Because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't when someone has this preconceived idea of who you are. Because their cognitive bias is going to literally, by default, discount any information that lies in conflict to their perception of you. Mm-hmm. Girl, I got too many things to do. You think I'm a bitch? Go right ahead. Yeah. Go right ahead. You think I'm that? Go right ahead. It's totally fine. So with that running in the background, it gave me the freedom to like focus on myself, right? So I manifested my husband, Anthony. So the book was, met him in 2010. The book went live in 2012. We got married in 2013. I immediately wrote My Road Beyond the Codependent Divorce, quick. It was like this avenue within myself was just open. Then I wrote Quantum Tools right behind that. Then it was Loving the Self Affirmations 1 and 2. Then it was Codependent Now What? It's Not You, It's a Program. Then it was Codependency Manifesto. So it was just like, once I stepped into that, it was just let it roll. Just let it roll. And then it was also in my family, your accomplishments were always shit on. So I just didn't tell them about my accomplishments. I didn't tell them anything. Nothing ever, never. I never told them anything because, first of all, I didn't need their validation. And so that was really important to me. Like there's no reason for me to tell them what's going on in my life. A, I don't need their validation, and B, they're going to shit all over it anyway. So without any of that energy flowing that way, I was free to be myself. And my life rapidly improved. I remember Anthony had a birthday party for me when I turned 50, and my dad walked into the restaurant. He's like, wow, you've
done well for yourself.
you have I don't recognize any of these people. Who are they? I said, they're my friends. He said, wow. It was hard for him to fathom that outside of this family that I could actually do well, which was interesting.
Did either of your siblings find recovery?
I would say they found awareness.
Okay.
I would say that they found the truth. Truth is very different than recovery. Because I can know I have cancer and do nothing about it. I can know I have cancer and not quit smoking. So I would say that they understand what's happened, but I would not say that they're in recovery, no.
That's so funny that you said that. So I found out I was an adult child at 7 years sober, but I heard a woman at an AA meeting talk about adult children of alcoholics, and I go home and I read the book and my mind's blown, and I go back the next week and I'm like, thank you so much for your share. And she was like, that's great, Andrea, but I just want you to know that like, it's going to take a lot more than reading this book. It's going to take you years and years. And I thought, lady, I'm 28. I don't have years. I need to have this shit fixed yesterday. And I really just hope that her childhood was like way more fucked up than mine. And so I was like, okay, I'll take a year off from dating.
Right.
That'll be good. Right. And I say, just like learning you have cancer doesn't make the cancer go away. Learning that my date issues in dating were related to my childhood was not sufficient enough to bring about any sort of change.
No.
But I think you have to be in that awareness. We often have to be in that awareness first and then feel the pain of that awareness before we step into action.
Yeah. I think that's all part of the plan. That's all part of the divine plan. You know, we incarnate on planet Earth with spiritual amnesia. We don't know how powerful we are. We don't know. And if we did, we'd be acting. Mm-hmm. Then our pain wouldn't be real. We'd be acting. So the very act or fact that we come here with spiritual amnesia and we feel so disconnected from our parents and life, and we're sabotaging our lives. The very fact that we do that and that's real and that's authentic, and we find the way to self-discipline, and we find the road back to the self, and we find the tools to master the self and to become self-actualized. And ultimately, I feel that our journey leads us towards this sense of oneness. I have always been connected to everything. I just didn't know it. The power to change my life it's never been outside of me. You know, higher power is in me. I am an extension of higher power, no different than my dog, right? My dog has consciousness. She dreams. So I've never not been an extension, or I've never not had access to this infinite intelligence. It was just trauma eclipsed it. And it's by acknowledging the trauma that eclipse starts to move a little bit. It's like, oh, acknowledge a little bit more. And you're right. It is the pain that moves us into action.
Yeah, fuck that.
I think that human beings have the potential to move into action without pain eventually.
Yeah, I'm not one of them. I haven't been yet, but
I just don't know that we're that consciously evolved yet, but I do think conversations like this
help.
They play part of the push forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you feel like really cultivated connecting with your higher power, and especially in those beginning years of recovery, what were the practices that you feel like allowed you to really tap into that?
First and foremost, meditation, because once I started understanding the subconscious mind, I understood I was literally programmed that below the age of 7, everybody is in a theta brainwave state. Theta is a hypnotic brainwave state, which means that you're being hypnotized rapidly. Mm-hmm. So, and that's when all your intrinsic memories are being formed, associated with riding a bike, associated with brushing your teeth, associated with tying your shoes. There's a lot of stuff a little human being by the time they're 7 needs to know at the unconscious level. But while we're downloading information for how to tie our shoes and look both ways before we cross the street, we're also being wired for a sense of self. We're being wired for the rules of engagement in our family. And so that's all implicit. Those of us, I had a client who said that he grew up his whole life, his mother was an alcoholic. And when he heard the ice hit the glass, he had a CPTSD response because he had been conditioned to know that hell was coming after a couple of drinks with his mom. And he would be in a state of trauma, watching her drink and seeing her face change and watching her body movements change. So he would dissociate, mm-hmm. right? And he would freeze and he would see it coming. And so now as an adult, and he would be triggered. That's intrinsic memory. So sight, sound, taste, touch, they're all, it's by default. And so when he would hear glass, ice hit a glass, he would have this CPTSD response. That's part of our theta brainwave programming. And so I realized that once I was putting all this research together, I thought, oh my God, I'm programmed. And so my reticular activating system, there's a lot of neurology here, but the reticular activating system is the part of the brain that's the gatekeeper. It has been designed by the parameters of childhood to decide what to allow to come into your conscious awareness and what to not allow. And so as simple as, it's really not simple, it's not funny, but for the case of making this really easy to understand is if I don't believe that I'm worthy, mm-hmm. then my subconscious mind cancels out any information to the contrary. Just like when I was a little girl and I was at the register, mm-hmm. My reticular activating system said, no, this doesn't fit. Doop, go get some potato chips.
Yeah, get those onion and garlic potato. When do they stop making those? Why do they stop flavor?
I don't know. So it's once I understood that, I knew that I approached it from a very pragmatic view and thought, I have to catch these thoughts. I didn't yet understand the silent observer and blah, 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 the power of now. I just, from a very pragmatic, almost like research point of view, it was like, slow down your thoughts, catch them. And so
meditation. What did that look like?
Meditation, 4 hours a day.
Silent meditation?
No, I didn't know how to meditate at all. So I was like, YouTube. You know, like YouTube was just happening, but I would look up guided meditations, pineal gland meditations, higher self meditations, chakra balancing meditations, anything, anxiety meditation, any type of meditation, guided meditation that allowed my conscious mind to check out, because I knew and I understood from my research of the subconscious mind that the subconscious mind is always active. It's always looking for a pattern. And so if I could spend enough time meditating or listening to a different pattern, then I could reprogram my reticular activating system. I could literally reprogram my subconscious mind with new information. Mm-hmm. And so that I woke up early in the morning and I did my journaling. So I was catching negative thoughts, codependent actions. How could I be less codependent? That was my journaling. Then I would do a meditation and I'd get on my day with the kids. The minute I had time, I came home, literally sat down on my little tiny couch because that's all I could afford. And I did another meditation. If I sat up and my mind was just right in some mental chatter, nope. I went back down, laid back down, did another meditation. Mm. If I sat up again and I was bombarded with mental chatter, I went back down. Sometimes 3-4 hours until it became, until I noticed that I could walk about and the mental chatter wasn't going on. My husband says to me now, what are you thinking about? I go, nothing. He's like, what? I said, I am really, there's no background noise so much anymore. I have to call it into consciousness because otherwise I'm enjoying the tree. I'm enjoying the sun. When I get into trouble, when I forget to do that work, because the default mode network of the brain is designed for autopilot. So whatever the subconscious tracks are, they come back to the surface without a conscious gatekeeper. So that's what that looked like for me. A lot of journaling, a lot of meditation, supreme accountability, reading everything I could about codependency, love addiction, holding myself accountable in my recovery work, and also how I was showing up as a person, as a mom, as a friend, just constantly policing myself and correcting what I knew was a product of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. With the negative beliefs of when you would notice that they were popping up, were you also like auto-correcting it with reverse beliefs, or you were just dipping it?
No, in the beginning, what I was doing was I remember I went into a dollar store and I grabbed a marble notebook because I came out of work and I looked in the rearview mirror of my car and I said, you look like shit today. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, who said that? Where did that voice come from? Right? Because that's not the way I would consciously want to speak to myself or my inner child. I thought, there it is. There's that automatic voice. That's my mother's voice. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, I got to get control over that voice. So again, another level of separating my consciousness from the voice. The voice is not me. It's an echo of the past. Mm-hmm. It's a pattern. And so I ran in and got a marble notebook and I titled the day, the time, like, you look like shit today. and I just kept taking this. It's like I said, I was like on a safari for negative thoughts. So I didn't correct anything yet. I just wanted to get a clear vision.
What the hell is going on up there?
Absolutely. It was like, and then it was like, again, another level of compassion. How could you not have asthma? How could you not have migraine headaches? How could you not have rashes? If that's the point of view that your body is listening to, how could you attract a healthy relationship? How could you sleep well? How could you make good choices around nutrition? You're always going to be grabbing for some form of garlic potato chips, whether it's a man, whether it's a friendship, whether it's food, whatever it is, until you gain control over it. So I was more interested in the beginning of getting like, okay, what is it? 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 And becoming the silent observer. So once I got a little bit of an idea of like, oh, that's what's going on inside of there, then it was, I'm going to reframe it. Then it was like, okay, when I have this thought, I'm going to think that thing.
Mm-hmm. Bravo. I know you're running on. I could talk to you for fucking ever. I really appreciate your everything.
I appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, I know, man. There's just so many people out there who don't know that they're an adult child.
Correct. Well, that's why I do, like when I do a webinar, I use that terminology.
Yeah, I really appreciate how often you use the term.
Yeah. And the last webinar I held, I even defined the adult child because by definition, an adult child is someone who approaches adult life from the position of a child, mm-hmm. you know, subservient, feeling less than, highly agreeable, lacks confidence, needs permission, you know, acts out, is not acting for our higher good. We tend to sabotage ourselves. We put our foot in our mouths. We can be very reactive, you know, rather than, you know, taking in all this data and looking at it from a critical point of view, and then deciding to make a choice based on all of the criteria, right? So even though I might want to punch you in the mouth, I probably won't, you know, because maybe right. I'm wrong, right?
So you talk, you know, you make a ton of content about narcissism. What are your thoughts on, like, do you think that this is a word that is being misused, overused? What are your thoughts?
I think that it's an important conversation to have because, although, yes, I think in lots of ways it is being misused, especially on YouTube, as far as I can see. However, I think it's an important topic to have because many adult children who feel subordinate, who don't feel good enough, who are struggling with codependency, oftentimes attract highly narcissistic people into their lives who exploit the need to be needed, mm-hmm. who exploit the lack of confidence, who exploit the abandonment trauma. And so I see a crossover between being the adult child of an alcoholic, struggling with low self-worth and abandonment trauma, and being attracted to a partner who is highly narcissistic, who mirrors our parents' energy, mm-hmm. right? Because a parent who is unaware of how their behavior is affecting their child is, in essence, swimming in narcissism. Mm-hmm. Alcoholism may be a culprit. Lack of awareness might be a culprit. Pain and trauma in their childhood might be a culprit. But for the sake of helping people figure out who they are in the context of a toxic relationship, I think explaining narcissism is very, very valuable because sometimes adult children are online. What's wrong with my partner? Why won't he talk to me? Why do I keep chasing my partner? Right? Or my partner keeps threatening to divorce me. What's wrong with me? And so I think it's an important conversation to have. My parents were narcissistic. And they were adult children of alcoholics. So there was a piece to that. So my aim is to cast a wide enough net that people who resonate with narcissistic parents might discover that they are actually an adult child. And you and I both know that the literature for adult children will benefit the child of a narcissist as much as it does the child of an alcoholic, whether or not that narcissistic parent drinks.
Yeah, you're so right. Is there anything you want to promote?
What happened?
Anything you want to promote?
Well, I do have a 12-week class that is perfect for adult children. And it's not an easy class. I am someone who believes in honing in on the actual reason for why you are the way you are. So the first couple of weeks. Yeah. Yeah, I've wasted too much time dancing around the mulberry bush. Like, tell me what's wrong with me. How did this happen? And how can I get better? So
is that just always available or do you run them in cohorts?
Well, tomorrow we relaunch it live, which means that if you buy it live, then you get access to me and four life coaches in a live Facebook group. And every Saturday morning at 9 a.m., I offer a 90-minute live stream where I'm answering questions live. And so you have access to a live Facebook group that's interactive, but you can also get it on demand and you can do the work on demand at your own pace in your own time. But that doesn't come with a live Facebook group. And that's 50% off the fee for the.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, I will put that in the show notes and I would love for you to come back.
Sure.
You just scratched the surface.
Thank you. I know. But you know what? Like you and I both know, you know, not knowing what's wrong is the biggest problem. And so scratching the surface is what we need to do.
Let's keep scratching that itch.
Yeah. Well, thank you for inviting me and keep doing what you're doing. I'm so proud of you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up today's episode. As always, I hope you heard something that could help you on your own journey. As always, I know that you did. As always, if you did not seek help, thank you, Lisa. What'd you guys think? I thought pretty damn good, right? Pretty damn good. When is the new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm coming out, y'all? Let's see here. Doesn't look like there's a date. So go check out the show notes for links to all of Lisa's shit. So I'm headed to Austin tomorrow. We have our second ever shit show retreat, which I'm super pumped about. And I don't know, sometimes I just pinch myself. It's like, what a cool thing that has transpired from a shitload of pain. You guys are listening to my voice. That's pretty cool. And I get to have these groups 3 times a week with people who feel like family. And now I get to go on vacation with people who feel like family. And we're just going to have fun and eat and play and dance. So grateful for all of you damn shit shows. So I'm going to go pack. I will see you next week for another fucking amazing episode of Adult Child. It's going to be super raw, super vulnerable, super sad if we already hear it. It's going to be a goodie, I promise.